Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories. We have stories that should thrill you a little and chill you a little.
It's amazing.
You will hear adventures sent in by you guys, classic stories from the pulp mags, and episodes from the golden age of radio. We have special segments like Ghost Stories with Sylvia.
That's amazing.
And the paranormal with Jason.
I think we're going to have a lot of fun.
So settle in for the next hour and enjoy the show. Oh, and you just might want to prepare yourself to be taken away from today.
Another 5-minute mystery.
This 5-Minute Mystery is being brought to you by Restoration. The story you are about to hear has never been on the show before. The reason? Simple. It was in terrible shape. I have done what I could to restore it, and I present it to you now.
This way, Inspector.
Thank you. Warden, what time did you say the murder took place?
We didn't discover the body until this morning, but the coroner set the time at about 9 last night.
Did he have any visitors?
Yes, 2. Here we are.
Uh-huh. So what was Johnson in for, anyway?
He was a member of that gang of bank robbers we were looking for. Of course, he was only a lookout, but we thought that if we kept him, we could catch the rest of the gang somehow.
I see. And how was he killed?
He was stabbed, and then propped up on that stool. The weapon hasn't been found yet.
You said he had 2 visitors last night?
Right. Fred Johnson, his brother, and Simpson, his lawyer. But they were both searched before they came in here.
I'd like to question them anyway.
Well, just as you say. They're waiting in my office now.
Are you Simpson?
That's right, Inspector. I was Mr. Johnson's lawyer.
And you came to see him last night?
Yes, I wanted to go over our case.
How long did you stay?
About 30 minutes.
I see. Call in his brother, will you, Warden?
Yes, certainly. Mr. Johnson, would you come in now, please?
Yes, Warden.
Mr. Johnson, this is Inspector Harris.
How do you do?
How are you? Won't you sit down?
Here.
Thank you, Warden, but I can manage.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson. I didn't realize...
That I'm blamed. It doesn't matter.
I'll try not to keep you long. Just want to ask you a few questions. You are Johnson's brother?
Yes, that's right.
And you came to see him last night?
Yes.
How long did you stay?
Only about 10 minutes. He said he didn't want or need my help, so I left.
Are you sure you're telling the truth?
Of course. Why do you ask?
Well, you were the last one to see your brother alive.
Are you accusing me of killing my own brother?
Well, one of you two did.
But I don't see how they could. They were both searched.
And yet, one of them did smuggle a knife in and kill Johnson. And I know who.
Who, Inspector?
You, Mr. Johnson.
How does the inspector know that Fred Johnson is the murderer? We'll give you the solution in just a minute, but first...
Great story for what it's worth. Good acting and all the neat things that these FFMs are known for, including the lack of useful clues. In fact, I think this one's going to come down to something that was not told to us or was on a need to know. The odd thing is, Fred is blind, and I would think he'd have a tough time doing the stabbing. But things like that have never stopped us before. It is what it is. So let's go see what we missed.
And now back to our story.
I murdered my brother. Well, that's preposterous. I was searched before I was allowed in.
Yes, Mr. Johnson, but I wonder if the guards took a look at your cane.
Give me that.
Just as I thought. Look, Warden, a knife concealed inside this cane.
Well, I'll be... But killing his own brother.
If you do a little more investigating, you'll find that he belongs to that gang of bank robbers, too. He was probably sent here to keep Johnson from talking. Well, Mr. Johnson, or whatever your name is, if you'll step this way, we've got a little cell we'd like to show you.
Well, it would have been nice if they had told us that Fred even had a cane. Also, there appears to be some question if Fred is even the brother. Anyway, this 5-Minute Mystery was brought to you by Restoration, the tool that lets us enjoy these old-time radio spots from the 1940s. So cool. Say that this show is on UFOs. However, it's not going to be like other programs that you've heard. I'm going to look at the subject by linking to our past. I will use old-time radio and news reports to do it. So to begin that, I need to introduce you to a major player in the news industry, Mr. Edward R. Murrow. Have you heard the name before? If not, he was an American journalist. He was generally referred to as Ed Morrow. He first came to prominence with a series of radio broadcasts for the news division of CBS during World War II. These reports were literally followed by millions of listeners in the United States. During the war, he assembled a team of correspondents who came to be known as the Morrow Boys. Morrow produced a series of reports that led to the censure of Senator Joseph McCarthy and the subject of communism in the United States. Most journalists of today agree that he is one of journalism's greatest figures, noting his honesty and integrity in delivering the news. How did he begin life? Morrow was born in Polecat Creek, North Carolina. His parents were Quakers, and he was the youngest of three brothers. His home was a log cabin without electricity or plumbing on a farm bringing in corn and hay. In high school, he was president of the student body and in his senior year excelled on the debate team. After graduation, Morrow enrolled at Washington State College, now Washington State University, in Pullman, Washington, and eventually majored in speech. After earning his bachelor degree in 1930, he moved to New York. Morrow joined CBS as the director of Talks and Education in 1935 and remained for the network for his entire career, spanning close to 30 years. When he was hired, CBS did not have a news staff except for announcer Bob Trout. Morrow was intrigued by Trout's on-air delivery, and Trout gave Morrow tips on how to communicate effectively on radio. Morrow was sent to London in 1937 to serve as the director of CBS European Operations. This new job was to persuade European figures to broadcast for CBS. What he did was hire journalist William L. Shear, and this marked the beginning of the Morrow Boys. It turned out that people would rather hear the news firsthand than filtered. In December 1945, Morrow reluctantly accepted the offer to become vice president of the network and head of CBS News. This led to his last report from London in March of 1946. His presence and personality shaped the newsroom. After the war, he maintained close friendships with his previous hires, including the members of the Morrow Boys. Younger colleagues at CBS became resentful towards this, viewing it as preferential treatment, and they formed the Morrow Isn't God Club. The club quickly disbanded when Morrow asked if he could join. Numerous programs, reports, and television shows would follow as his career continued with CBS until January of 1961. Morrow resigned from CBS to accept a position as head of the United States Information Agency. President John F. Kennedy offered Morrow the position, which he viewed as a timely gift. Health issues forced him to resign from the USIA. CBS reportedly invited Morrow to return, however, Morrow declined the offer. He was a chain smoker throughout his life. Morrow was never seen without his trademark Camel cigarette. It was reported that he smoked between 60 and 65 cigarettes a day. See It Now, one of Morrow's television series, was the first program to report about the connection between smoking and cancer. During the show, Morrow said that, I doubt I could spend a half hour without a cigarette with any comfort or ease. Unfortunately, he developed lung cancer and lived for 2 years after an operation to remove his lung. Morrow died at his home on April 27, 1965, 2 days after his 57th birthday. That was a sad ending to his life, but he did leave behind something that America could surely use today: owning the complete responsibility to present the news. I leave you with this famous quote from Morrow himself. "The obscure we see eventually. The completely obvious, it seems, takes a bit longer." How about that? The date is April 7th, 1950, and this is A Moment in Time. What you're about to hear is the great Edward R. Morrow himself. It is a report that CBS presented to the American public on the subject of unidentified flying objects. It is interesting to note that this report comes only 3 years after the Roswell incident. Keep that in mind as you listen. Also keep in mind that this report is nearly 70 years old. I present this as it was to the world on that day in April.
This is Edward R. Murrow. We're going to talk about flying saucers. We're going to talk about them from the standpoint of reporters, not as comedians, not as sensationalists. For the past 3 years, a large number of perfectly sane and reliable people have been involved in this flying saucer business. Even those of us who have never seen one have become involved. We read about them, talk about them, wonder about these reports of strange phenomena in the skies. So almost from the start, CBS has been following the story. We have been collecting material on flying saucer observations for many months, checking, cross-checking, trying to track down leads, no matter how far afield they took us. This, tonight, is our report. We frankly admit that we don't know whether flying saucers actually exist. We've never seen one. We are going to bring you the facts at hand. What they add up to? Well, that's for you to decide. That's up to you. It all began just a little less than 3 full years ago. It began in the sky over western Washington, up there in the hip pocket of the country. Early one June morning in 1947... a C-46 Marine transport, with 32 Marines aboard, crashed in the vicinity of Mount Rainier. An air search was immediately organized to locate the downed plane. Among the many service and private flyers who participated in this search was Mr. Kenneth Arnold, a businessman of Boise, Idaho, a veteran pilot in forest fire control work, a man with 6 years' experience flying over the rugged terrain in and around Mount Rainier. Yesterday morning, we spoke to Mr. Arnold over the phone. We asked him to repeat for us, in his own words, what he saw in the sky over Mount Rainier on June 24, 1947. We recorded what he said, and we're going to play it for you now. The slight beep that you will hear intermittently is required by law to let both parties of a phone conversation know they are being recorded. Here now is Mr. Kenneth Arnold.
"It was while I was searching for this crash that I noticed a terrific blue flash pass nose of my airplane. I noticed that the flash came from a chain of very peculiar-looking objects that were rapidly approaching Mount Rainier at about 107 degrees. This chain of objects were nine in number. I assumed at the time they were a new formation or a new type of jet, though I was baffled by the fact that they did not have any tails. It passed almost directly in front of me, but at a distance of about 23 miles, which is not very great, in the air. I judged their wingspan to be at least 100 feet across. The sighting did not particularly disturb me at the time, except that I had never seen planes of that type."
Mr. Arnold, after landing, made a routine report of what he had seen to a Civil Aeronautics Administration representative. Promptly forgot the matter. Until the wheels of publicity began to turn. The floodgates opened.
"I never could understand at that time why the world got so upset about this. These things didn't seem to be a menace. I believe they had something to do with our army and air force.
On three different occasions, Mr. Arnold was questioned by military intelligence. They expressed doubt as to the accuracy of some of his reported observations.
That's right. Now, of course, some of the reports they did take from newspapers, which did not quote me properly. Now, when I told the press, they misquoted me, and in the excitement of it all, one newspaper and another one got it so snarled up that nobody knew just exactly what they were talking about, I guess.
Here's how the name Flying Saucer was born.
These objects more or less fluttered like they were, boats on very rough water or a very rough air of some type. And when I described how they flew, I said if they flew like you take a saucer and throw it across the water, most of the newspapers misunderstood and misquoted that, too. They said that I said that they were saucer-like. I said they flew in a saucer-like fashion.
That was an historic misquote. While Mr. Arnold's original explanation has been forgotten, the term flying saucer has become a household word. Few people realize that Mr. Arnold has reported seeing these same strange objects in the sky on three other occasions. He says that some pilots in the Northwest have reported seeing them on eight separate occasions. We asked for his own personal opinion on the nature of what he and the others had seen.
I don't know how best to explain that. I more or less have reserved an opinion as to what I think, naturally being a natural-born American. If it's not made by our science or our Army Air Forces, I'm inclined to believe that it's of an extraterrestrial origin.
Extraterrestrial origin? You mean you think there's a possibility they may be coming out of space from other planets? I suppose that's pretty hard for people to take seriously.
Well, I'll tell you this much. All the airline pilots, none of us have appreciated being laughed at. We made our reports essentially to begin with because we thought that if our government didn't know what it was, it was only our duty to report it to our nation and to our Air Force out of it. I think it's something that is of concern to every person in the country. And I don't think it's anything for people to get hysterical about. Now, that's just my frank opinion of it.
So that's how it all began. That was the trigger action. Kenneth Arnold's story went scudding over the news wires. Radio and newspapers picked it up. And then within days, the country broke out into a flood of flying saucer observations. Many of these reports, a great many of them, obviously could be discounted. Others, reports from perfectly competent, sober, and reliable observers, found no easy answer. In the face of this, late in 1947... the chief of staff of the Air Forces, at that time General Carl Tui Spots, sent a directive to the Air Materiel Command, located at Wright Field, Ohio.
The Air Materiel Command is directed to set up a project whose purpose is to collect, collate, evaluate, and distribute to interested government agencies and contractors all pertinent information concerning sightings of phenomena in the atmosphere, which can be construed to be of concern to the national security.
So was born...
between 300 and 400 miles per hour.
Remember, these were trained observers, Air Force men.
The objects reportedly traveled in a straight line, taking the mean reported speed, 350 miles per hour, and the time in sight, 1/2 hour. The objects must then have traveled 175 miles while in sight. If the objects were of such proportions as to be seen at that distance, it is believed that more details could have been observed at the first sighting.
And the Air Materiel Command opinion on the Muroc Air Base sightings was this.
This report is a result of misinterpretation of the nature of real stimuli, probably research balloons.
Another report on January 7th, 1948. Tech Sergeant Quinton A. Blackwell, chief operator of the control tower at Godman Field, an Air Force base at Fort Knox, Kentucky, spotted a strange object hovering over the south portion of the field. In a matter of minutes, a flight of four P-51 fighter planes approaching the field were contacted by radio and asked to chase the object. Leader of the flight was Captain Thomas F. Mantell, Jr., a veteran of the Normandy invasion with some 3,000 flying hours to his credit. At 2:45, Mantell reported by radio.
Object directly ahead and above and moving about half my speed. Going up to take a look.
At 3:15, Mantell reported again.
Object still ahead and above. Moving at about my speed or faster. 360 miles per hour. The thing looks metallic and is of tremendous size. I'm trying to close in for a better look.
By now, Mantell and his flight were at about 15,000 feet. They had no oxygen equipment. At 18,000 feet, the escorting planes turned back, but Mantell kept climbing. His next report came from 20,000 feet.
Going to 25,000. If no closer, we'll abandon search.
That was the last report from Captain Thomas Mantell. At approximately 25,000 feet, it is believed he blacked out for want of oxygen. His plane climbed another 5,000 feet and then went into a dive. When it crashed, parts of it were scattered around an area covering 1/6 of a mile. Project Saucer's conclusion.
It seems probable that the object observed was the planet Venus.
Later, in a report dated April 27, 1949, this conclusion was reversed. Further investigation showed the elevation and azimuth readings of Venus, and the object as reported at specified time intervals, just didn't jibe. The object Captain Mantell chased to his tragic death is now officially marked
unidentified.
In all, Project Saucer investigated 375 cases. The report takes in 244 different observations. Just yesterday, we asked Major General William F. McKee, Assistant Vice Chief of Staff, United States Air Forces, to summarize the conclusions reached by Project Saucer. He said,
during 2 years of thorough investigation, no evidence was found which would indicate that the reported flying saucers were anything but the result of natural phenomena. On the other hand, all the evidence indicated that the reports of unidentified flying objects could be accounted for under three major headings. One, misinterpretation of various conventional objects. Two, a mild form of hysteria. Three, or simple hoaxes. It has been suggested that what people actually have been seeing is the result of some of our own secret experiments, guided missiles or new types of planes or flying weapons. This is emphatically not the case. None of the three military departments nor any other agency in government is conducting experiments, classified or otherwise, with disc-shaped flying objects which could be a basis for the reported phenomena.
On December 27, 1949, Project Saucer went out of existence. The flying saucers, however, refused to follow the project into limbo. Just possibly one of the reasons behind the stubbornness of the saucers to accept the mantle of oblivion was an article that appeared in True magazine just about the time Project Saucer was abandoned. It had previously been shown pretty conclusively that the number of sighting reports over a period of months usually followed closely the amount of publicity given to flying saucer observations. A lot of stories, a lot of sightings. Few stories, few sightings. Psychologists call this mass suggestion. But to return to the True magazine article printed in December of 1949. Some percentage of the new wave of flying saucer reports can certainly be chalked off to mass suggestion. But again, as in the first reports, there remained that same unexplained percentage of reliable, trained observers who claim to have seen some object or objects wheeling, whirling, zooming, slicing, or hovering in the sky. Douglas Gourley of Laguna Beach, California, is an example. Here's his story.
After 14 months as an anti-aircraft observer with a searchlight battery, and also 18 months as a seacoast and anti-aircraft observer with another searchlight battery. I was driving north March 21st on 101 Highway at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon when my attention was distracted by the sunlight reflecting off some objects. I counted 8 of them, proceeding directly out to sea at 2,000 feet altitude. They gave the appearance of being made out of aluminum, and I could observe a perfect circle outline of these craft. They were going, I would say, approximately 150 miles an hour. They were definitely a powered craft of some sort.
Here's a report from Selma, Alabama.
We were riding along the open country and had been observing a very beautiful sunset. And as the sun dipped over the western horizon, I looked to my right. And there in the sky were three small lights, which to me appeared to be three very small clouds. I looked steadily And I said, no, they are not clouds, they are airplanes. Then I called my husband's attention to it. And he said, no, those are not airplanes, they are lights. And we observed them very closely. But being in motion ourselves, to us, they were motionless because we didn't stop. But as we rode along, for something over a mile, they hung there in the sky, and they were, to us, had the appearance of tubes of fluorescent light, a beautiful, silvery, pink-tinged moonlight. And I said to my husband, that gives me a feeling that God is trying to say something to us. And we have had that feeling within us since.
By mid-March of this year, the flood of flying saucer sightings had hit a new peak. Into many of these reports, there now crept a new and somewhat eerie tone. The feeling that these flying saucers were something out of this world, possibly interplanetary aircraft, sent from some distant celestial sphere to investigate what manner of life managed to exist here on Earth. In line with this, we went to Dr. Donald Menzel, professor of astrophysics at Harvard University and associate director of the famous Harvard Observatory, to find out just how feasible any such idea might be. Dr. Menzel had this to say.
Well, I suppose that anything is possible, but I consider it extremely unlikely.
Well, what could these flying bodies actually be, Dr. Menzel?
Sun shining from a very distant plane, shining so that you could see that there was an object there, but the plane so far away that you couldn't hear it. Weather balloon. You have the bright round patch at fairly high altitude, sometimes three or four of them attached together. And then again, pieces of paper carried aloft. When it gets up to 200 or 300 feet, you can't tell whether it's 100 feet or 1,000 or 10,000 feet away.
Prior to the middle of March, most observations, certainly all those which could be credited to reliable, sober sources, stated that the object seen was a good distance away, a distance that ranged from a few miles to 10 and 20. But on March 16th, a physician, a man who holds a private pilot's license, reported that he had seen some strange, unidentifiable type of flying body at close range. Dr. Craig Hunter of Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, had this experience.
We're going north on Route 153 from Clearfield, Pennsylvania, towards Penfield, Pennsylvania. And about 9 miles out of Clearfield, and I begin to hear a hissing, whistling sort of a sound, something that was completely strange to me. And then I looked up into the sky, and coming from a southeasterly direction to a northwesterly direction was this flying disc, or for the want of a better name, a flying saucer. It was, I would say, around 150 feet around in circumference, and there was three distinct parts of it. There was an inner circle, a metal circle, which rotated around this inner circle, and an outside circle, which about one-third of the area on each side was covered with openings somewhat similar to an airliner opening. Now, this inner circle rotated anticlockwise very slowly, and it went over me, practically right over my head, and I would say it was traveling at a speed approximately 60 to 70 miles per hour. I would say that the plane was approximately 250 to 300 feet above me, not over 400 feet. It was of a dirty aluminum color, and I got a tendency to indicate the southern edge as sloping up, which would indicate to me that it was about 15 to 20 feet thick at the center. It would give you the idea that it was a rocket type of combustion, rather. It didn't give you the indication of a make and break, like a motor or anything like that. It was a continuous hissing, whistling sound. The conditions were very, very fine for observing it. I mean that it was just as clear as a bell, and I could distinctly see each and every detail as to the outline of it.
In order to check the whole question of design, to find out whether or not a saucer-like object such as the one described by Dr. Hunter could maintain itself in flight, according to the basic laws of aerodynamics, we call for the opinion of one of the nation's outstanding aeronautical engineers. Hall Hibbard is vice president and chief engineer of Lockheed Aircraft, And here is what he has to say over the beep recording telephone.
Well, my feeling is that that it is possible to build and fly something that looks like a saucer just from the technical standpoint, but I do not believe that there is such a thing at this time. I do not know of anything that would be considered in that category. I'm very familiar with pretty much what's going on in the way of research and development, and I know of nothing that would be considered as flying saucers or flying saucer material. You can make something that looks like a saucer fly, if anybody would ever want to do it. But I do not believe it would be possible with our present knowledge to have them make the speeds and everything that everybody has been talking about.
The flying saucer story came back into sharp focus on Monday of the present week. On that day, the United States News and World Report, a national news magazine, and Henry J. Taylor, a radio commentator, both came out with flat statements that flying saucers actually exist. Mr. Taylor said that there are two or more different objects that have been sighted and labeled flying saucers. One of these objects, the true flying saucer, according to Mr. Taylor, is a missile round in shape, varying in size from 20 inches to 250 feet in diameter. Some are guided, others are not. The U.S. News and World Report article mentions nothing about these objects. The magazine, however, describes a jet-propelled aircraft of revolutionary design that agrees in some details with Mr. Taylor's second secret aircraft, a piloted plane capable of high speeds and high maneuverability. Both accounts agree that the present models stem directly from the XF-5U-1, the so-called Flying Pancake, a small edition of which was built and flown in 1942. Last night, we put a special recording line into the home of Mr. Charles H. Zimmerman of the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, the man who originally designed the XF-5U-1. We asked him about the plane, whether it ever actually flew.
This aircraft never flew. The official designation of the aircraft was the XF-5U-1, which was to be a high-performance Navy fighter. However, a low-powered, lightly loaded version of this craft, called a V-173, made a large number of successful flights. I conceived the original idea for this craft back in 1933.
As a top plane designer, we asked Mr. Zimmerman to give us his opinion as to whether or not a plane could be built that could hover like a helicopter, then take off at almost supersonic speeds. He said,
it would be possible using modern turboprop engines to build a machine of this type, which would be capable of hovering and of also flying at all forward speeds up to possibly 550 or 600 miles per hour.
To follow through on the problem of whether or not disc-shaped objects could actually fly, we got in touch with Mr. David C. Prince, Vice President of the General Electric Company and Chief of its General Engineering and Consulting Laboratory. Mr. Prince was having no part of flying saucers.
My thought is simply that the ability of some people to kid themselves is extraordinary. For instance, the effect of searchlights on clouds has been taken to be flying discs. Even radar evidence is not conclusive here, because rain in the clouds would show up on a radar screen. The only saucer-shaped aircraft which we know has flown, and that only a few times, is a propeller-powered disc developed by NACA. As a matter of fact, a cigar-shaped craft with a single revolving wing, jet-powered, could be faster and certainly would be much more maneuverable. In flight, this plane might look like a disc because of the halo created by its rapidly revolving wing. Such a craft would have flight characteristics similar to a hummingbird's.
Late this afternoon, we tried to tote up the score. On one desk, we had a pile of clippings, news reports, recordings of eyewitness accounts of flying saucer observations. We had the Taylor broadcast, the U.S. News and World Report article. On another desk, we had our Project Saucer report, the transcripts of our conversations with leading scientists and engineers, who, to use a gentle phrase, discounted the possibility of any such thing as a flying saucer. On that desk, too, was the news ticker dispatch from the United States submarine base at Key West, Florida, a dispatch that quoted President Truman's press secretary, Charles Ross, as saying that President Truman has no knowledge of any secret project by this government that would give substance to the existence of such objects. Ross also said that both the Air Force and the Navy deny that such objects exist. We tried to add it all up. We admit that now, as before we started our case, we have no opinion. The figures just don't add up. So we went to the public. We went to the man and the woman on the street to see how they were reacting to this barrage of positive sightings and just as positive denials. We wondered how they felt. They told us.
Well, I think there's more to it than meets the eye, and I think it's more to it than what they're writing about.
Personally, I don't think such a thing exists. I don't see how it could.
I have a confidence that something on that order may exist. I lived in North Carolina in 1903 when the reporter for the New York World was fired for reporting that the Wright brothers flew.
Some say they're stars, some say they're enemy action, and all kinds of things, but I really don't know.
There must be something to it.
Purely what? Imagination. I didn't believe it at first, but now I'm beginning to believe it.
Most of the thing is a flying saucer.
Well, I believe President Truman, like the rest of us, has a right to his own opinion.
And now, just in case all this has added to the celestial confusion about your heads, we've summarized the data we've been able to gather, sorted out the points of agreement and disagreement among those who claim to have seen flying saucers. Here is what we found. Nearly all these observers are in agreement on the color of the objects. It's a metallic color, they say, something like aluminum or silver. Almost everybody agrees the objects are generally disc-shaped, but with wide variations, sometimes balloon-like or resembling a giant rubber ball. Still others describe them as elongated cigar-shaped things. Speed of the saucers has been estimated at from 0 to 1,200 miles an hour. And when we get into the question of maneuverability, the observers seem not to be able to find the precise or adequate words. They say that the saucers hover, accelerate, and decelerate rapidly. They say that some of the objects flutter, oscillate, drift, whirl, or float. There seems to be no fixed pattern of flight in cases where more than one or two disks have been reported. But several persons have said that in group flights, one of the disks seems to be of a distinct color, indicating, possibly, that this off-colored disk was the monitor or the control disk for the others. A small percentage of the observers said the disks bore light, and in five cases, at points as far apart as Alabama and California, the viewers said the disks suddenly disappeared in flight. But when we get around to estimating altitudes at which the objects were sighted, we find that some observers say they saw them at 250 feet. Others guessed the disks were at 40,000 feet in the sky. While one observer estimated the number of disks seen at 100, nearly all thought the number was less than 10. And about half those who claimed to have seen the objects said they saw only single saucers. Well, these are the things men and women in various parts of the United States say they have seen in the sky. Men of science and high government officials cast a skeptical eye at these reported sightings of celestial phenomena. So far, in the course of this broadcast, there have been no reliable reports of the sighting of any new flying saucers. Frankly, we don't know the answer. We wonder, do you believe in flying saucers?
You've been listening to The Case of the Flying Saucer, a special report narrated by Edward R. Murrow. The Case of the Flying Saucer was based on extensive research collected with the aid of CBS-affiliated stations and CBS newsmen across the country. Portions of this broadcast were transcribed. This program was written by Irv Tunick, directed by John Dietz, and produced by Robert Bendick and Irving Gitlin.
There were a couple things that struck me about that presentation. Did you notice the number of events and stories they had? Impressive stories, some of which I've never even heard before. I have to say how eerie it was to listen to that 70-year-old program and realize how little progress has been made towards the answer of the question, are there really UFOs in the sky? Hearing that by CBS and Ed Morrow really was something, wasn't it? However, they failed to mention the largest scale UFO event of the century, Roswell, New Mexico. If you're not familiar, let me remind you. On July 8, 1947, Public Information Officer Walter Haught issued a press release stating that the personnel from the field's 509th Operation Group had recovered a flying disc, which had crashed on a ranch near Roswell. A full day later, a second press release stated that a United States Air Force balloon crashed at a ranch near Roswell, New Mexico. That's what they told the world, and even today, we can't be sure that the whole truth will ever be known. My question is, why didn't they mention this event on that CBS program? Food for thought. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories. They have over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, computer, Kindle. Whatever you have, you can listen to Audible on it. So what am I listening to? Alien Encounters, True Life Stories of Aliens, UFOs, and Other Extraterrestrial Phenomenon. In this compelling examination of stories, author Rupert Matthews looks afresh at key episodes of alien activity on Earth and sheds light on the many mysterious phenomena associated with it. From Roswell to Taizé, the book dissects fascinating eyewitness accounts of communication and contact with alien beings, as well as chilling cases of abduction. It also sifts through evidence of governmental cover-ups. Here's a clip from the beginning of the book.
I first became interested in UFOs during the Great Warminster Mystery, as it was then known, back in the 1960s. I was just a child at the time, but the exciting stories in the press caught my imagination. The idea that aliens from another planet could be visiting our quiet English countryside fired my imagination. We had friends in the area, so I was able to visit the town that was quickly becoming legendary and spend time up on Cradle Hill looking for flying saucers. I didn't see any, but that did nothing to dampen my enthusiasm. Since then, I have grown up, got a job, and had a family, but I have never forgotten the excitement of those early days. As the story of alien encounters has unfolded, I have been a keen enthusiast. I followed the first stirrings of the Roswell incident with interest. I kept abreast of affairs on the UFO front and was amazed by the revelations coming from those who had suffered alien abductions. And like so many other people, I dashed to see the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, great cinema. And then I decided to sit down one day and think about it all. I trawled back through my newspaper cuttings and library of first-hand accounts. I was looking for some clue as to what was really going on. Everyone seemed to have an opinion. Some thought aliens were visiting Earth, others that this was impossible. Still more subscribed to the concept that the U.S. government was guilty of a huge cover-up, and a few believed every word the U.S. government said. I decided to get right back to the only evidence that counts, the reports given by those who have had an alien encounter. I came at these reports afresh, trying to clear my mind of any preconceived notions or ideas. I looked for features that the reports had in common, that might tie them together and give a clue as to the solution to the puzzle.
Now, doesn't that narrator sound just a little bit like Mark Twain? It did to me. The book was actually narrated by Bill Roberts, and he does an amazing job of bringing the stories to life. There are 10 casebook studies that give in-depth analysis of some of the most important alien encounters of all time. These include the pilot who saw a formation of an alien aircraft, the Sicaro incident, and the encounter of Betty and Barney Hill on Highway 3. This book meticulously researched the strange events that continue to spark fierce debate today. If you doubt the existence of extraterrestrials, prepare to be convinced. You can have alien encounters today. Here's what Audible has set up for us. They are offering a free audiobook and 30 days to give you the opportunity to check out their service. This includes free access to the Audible Plus catalog, which is updated monthly with new titles. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories. Again, that's audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories, and you can get your free book today. Thank you, Audible. In keeping with our theme today, I'm going to bring back one of the best stories we've ever had on the podcast. It originally aired on episode number 312, which dates back to January of 2018. I still have no idea if this one's real, and I never heard from Richard again. Intrigued? Here is his story. Well, we have a UFO story sent in to us by Richard. Richard is not his real name, nor is he from any place in the United States. Confused? I received this cryptic email several months back. I read it to you now, unedited. I have a story I want to tell on your show, but I don't want you to know where you got it or who sent it. I will write story down to best of my ability, but know that English is not my first language. My wife is an American, and we enjoy American things. If this were known outside my country, it could cause trouble. You are welcome to interpret and use my story as you want. I only ask you assign it to the name Richard. Do you agree? Well, I sent Richard a return email saying that I would love his story and would do my best job at trying to interpret it. Keep the feel and the events the same. I did not receive a response, and quite frankly, I forgot about it, thinking the whole thing was a sham. Last week, I finally received the story from Richard and immediately set to work translating it. What you're about to hear is what I came up with. To Richard, I say, I hope I did it justice and that you like it. Please write me back and let me know if you can. Here is Richard's story, The Night We All Feared. I am in the military and as such am subject to certain laws and restrictions. Simply put, what happens on the job stays on the job. If I choose to discuss a thing that happens, it could lead to imprisonment, or best case, dismissal. Because of this, I hesitate to share my story. In the end, I want to tell it, and this seems to be the best and safest way. My wife and I love your podcast and listen when we can get to the Internet Cafe. We've been known to use our entire hour just downloading podcasts from America to listen to later. Enough about that. It is what it is, and in truth, we are actually quite happy. Here is my story. My group was assigned guard duty at the west gate of a government-controlled series of warehouses. While the contents of these are of some interest, they're not necessarily military or warlike stuff. The truth is, I really don't know what is there, but that night, Building Number 7 had a lot of activity. We were told to be sharp, no one could pass without proper identification, and must have the day's code word. A black van pulled up to the gate. It had no identification marks, which was very strange. The driver stepped out of the van, and we began our inspection. He had all the proper papers and the day's code word. As per protocol, we had to inspect the contents of the van. Everything inside were in crates, and each had the proper seal. We passed him through. One of the guards who had been inside the van started to complain about nausea. I too felt a little sick, but it soon passed, and we all went back to duty. About an hour later, the guard who had been in the van vomited and then passed out. The officer called for assistance for our fallen friend. It came, but it came too fast. Usually medics were not stationed at this place. They took him away, and none of us ever recall seeing him again. The rest of the evening was quiet until about 2 a.m. Building 7 began to glow. None of us knew what was happening. The officer in charge called the gatehouse, but got no reply. We all wanted to run to the building in support, but our leader reminded us that our job was clear. We were to protect and set about doing just that. I was ordered into the woods to set a flanking point in case of unlawful entry. Screams broke out through the air, coming from what was now a white and blue glow. We could no longer see Building 7, and it hurt our eyes to look in that direction. Then it all just stopped. The glow faded away, and the building remained. Then came the explosion. It was not one of fire and smoke, but splitting wood and steel. A shape rose from the wreckage. It was glowing blue and white. It shot up into the night sky at an impossible speed and was gone. Finally, the all clear sounded, followed by a flurry of activity around the compound. We received our orders and stayed on duty at that gate for the next 14 hours with no relief. All of us were taken by truck to a shadow location. Call it that because I had never been there before or since. We were debriefed, told never to discuss the incident, and all were reassigned to different companies. I don't ask you to believe my story. It feels good just to get it off my chest. I cannot and will not tell you where this happened, when, or even my real name. Keep the podcast coming, and those 5-minute mysteries make my wife laugh. Thank you, Richard. What can I say about this? I really don't know how to feel. This podcast is all about stories, and this one definitely fits the bill. Do I believe it? Part of me wants to, but my brain tells me that all of this is impossible. I tried to trace Richard's IP address. All I can say is that it came from a Google Gmail server, and that's it. I'm not any kind of hacker, so the trail ends for me there. I had quite a time editing this story. Some of the language didn't make any sense. For example, Richard called the black van a Touser truck. T-O-O-S-E-R. I couldn't find any reference to that other than an obscure YouTube video. Richard did not use the word warehouse. Instead, he said Lagerhaus. And that is completely off. Lager is a type of beer, but why guard beer? So many questions, but in the end, it is a great story. So I thank Richard for it. If it is true, you had some adventure, my friend. We have two listener stories for today. Both are on the current topic of UFOs or flying saucers. The first comes from Terrell Copeland, a former U.S. Marine. Copeland's story began 2 years ago with a UFO sighting he said was captured on his cell phone from his apartment in downtown Suffolk, Virginia. Here is his story. It was orbs of light. Just big balls of light. They weren't moving. One was solid white, the other was directly across the street from it, up 300 feet above ground, and was changing colors rapidly. Something's wrong here, I said to myself. Maybe I'm in over my head. I'm not supposed to be looking at this thing. I decided to post my video to YouTube. This led to something I never expected. A strange visitor came to my front door. I woke up from a nap by the sound of someone trying to enter my apartment. So I went to the door and said, "Who is it?" There was no answer. It was still. You know, you could see the doorknob moving and, like, scratching at the door. I keep a firearm. It was on my table. I thought I was going to go get it. I tried to move towards the table, but I was in complete paralysis. The only thing I could move were my eyes. I felt a cool chill go through my body, and then I heard a voice through the door say,
"You don't need that weapon. I won't harm you."
Then the world went blank. I woke up 4 hours later in my bed. It was past midnight, and I felt at peace. This event led to a series of missing time. During a span of 3 nights, I missed a total of 4 hours, and not as a result of sleep. One more thing. I think I got a look at the man, or whatever it was, at the door. While it isn't a memory, it's more of an impression. He was tall, wore some kind of black hat, and had what I think was a beard. Odd, I know, but that's what I saw, I think. Terrell Copeland, Suffolk, Virginia. Creepy stuff, but yet you seem at peace with it. Thank you, Terrell, for sharing your story. This next story is a short one, and I received it some time ago. It comes from Montana and was sent in by Rosalina Ashford. She writes, "Hey Ron, I heard you asking for UFO stories, but I myself prefer the title Flying Saucers. That's because that's what I saw. My husband and kids were gone for the weekend to the rodeo. I usually went with them, but this time I decided I needed some me time. We have a ranch-style house near Whitefish. The view from our living room is nothing but mountains and ski slopes. I was sitting with a glass of Chateau Lafayette Rothschild, a wonderful and truly expensive red wine. I was watching the world go by when a light appeared above the mountains. It was bobbing up and down and could not have been an airplane. It got brighter and brighter as it came closer. Finally, it buzzed the house and was gone. I ran outside, but there was no sign of it anywhere. It was saucer-shaped, with a circle of lights around its edges. I didn't see any windows of any types, and there were no markings that I could see. I have no evidence, and no, it was not the wine." Rosalina Ashford, Whitefish, Montana. Well, that is a short and simple story, and I love it. I looked up the wine that you mentioned. Chateau Lafayette Rothschild is available at wine.com. It has a good level of tannins, a balanced structure, well-defined aromas, a deep purple color, and a spicy yet woody bouquet. If you're interested, it sells for $729 a bottle. Thank you for your story, Rosalina. Well, those are our stories this time. Remember, if you have one to share, head to the main website and click on the submission banner. Make your stories our stories. Well, that was episode number 484, and these are the people that made it happen. Richard, Terrell Copeland, and Rosalina Ashford. Those were great stories today. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, head to ronsamazingstories.com. There you will find any of the links I mentioned and how to contact us. Do you want to help the show? The best thing you can do is to tell your friends all about it, and please leave reviews or feedback wherever you listen. Clicking that follow or like button makes us grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.